Hi, everyone, and welcome to this new podcast, Luxury Insight, in partnership with fashionnetwork.com. Today, we're very happy to welcome Maximilian Bittner, who's the CEO of Vestiaire Collective, a company that we don't need to introduce anymore. Maximilian will share with us great insights about the deployment of the company. So have a great day and a beautiful podcast.
Good day, everybody. In today's podcast with fashionnetwork.com and Luxury Insight, we're going to talk to an executive who is running one of France's great new online success stories and a very interesting brand called Vestiaire Collective. And he's had a particular career which we'll discuss. May introduce Maximilian Bittner.
Nice to meet you.
My pleasure, who is a Bavarian who now runs a company in Paris. So how did you end up becoming the CEO of Vestiaire Collective?
Sure. Firstly, thank you for having me.
Sure.
It's a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Apologies again for supporting the wrong football club, but you'll get there at some point. I joined Vestiaire about 18 months ago now. The way I ended up here was after building and founding and building the previous company I ran called Lazada in Southeast Asia. That company was sold to Alibaba. And
what did it remind her?
Lazada is a general e-commerce website like Amazon or like Alibaba. It was launched back in 2012 across 6 Southeast Asian markets: Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Philippines, Vietnam, and Singapore. We scaled the business over a 6-7 year period, riding quite a few big super trends like the mobile phone explosion, middle class explosion, tech finance explosion. We're able to scale the business, in what is quite a tough region, but a very exciting region because it's such a big population and so much consumption growth. And we sold the business, over a couple of years period between 2016 and 2018 to Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce number one.
What was its particular? What made it?
What made it unique?
Yeah.
I think Lazada back then had a few things which really drove its success. The first one was really its logistics. When we came there, e-commerce was very nascent. Logistics, when people talk about, Europe or the US or China, the logistics was already there. The payment infrastructure was already there. When we came to Southeast Asia, markets like Philippines or Indonesia, none of that was really there. So we went about basically building our own logistics. I think when I left, we had about 15,000 logistics workers, over 10 warehouses. We had our own fleet. We worked with 100 and plus logistics partners. I mean, it was a full-on logistics machine. And we also had a huge catalog of both third-party merchandise, but also first-party brands. We were only the second global distributor of Apple in the world online, which Amazon still to this day isn't. So I think we had a huge catalog, a huge assortment. And I think we had this vision of looking at Southeast Asia not as the fragmented area that it is, and most people look at it, but really look at it as a region and really seeing it as a opportunity and a one-stop shop for opening up brands and bringing them to Southeast Asia. So really having a regional mindset. And
where was it based?
I was based in Singapore. So the headquarters was Singapore, and then we had offices across the 6 main markets.
And what was this turnover when you left?
Oh, it was big. I don't know, 4 or 5 billion. GMV, yeah.
So then what attracted you to come to Paris and work with Vestiaire Collective?
So I left the business Lazada back in 2018. Like most founders and especially people who do e-commerce, I just love what I do. I love interacting with consumers. I love the power of e-commerce. I knew I wanted to go back to Europe, and I knew I had a rough idea what excited me. I really saw, in Asia, in China, in Southeast Asia, e-commerce developing in a very different way than you would know from Europe or the US, which is very much Amazon dogmatized. That's the way we shop e-commerce is driven by the way Amazon operates, and most other websites and apps copy them. In Asia, e-commerce is developed differently, largely driven by Alibaba and partly by us in Southeast Asia. And that experience is much more around engagement, much more around gamification. It's much more around empowering smaller sellers. So it's a slightly different shopping experience. And when I looked at Europe and I wanted to move back to Europe, I kind of saw a big opportunity to have that kind of approach to e-commerce, you know, in the region, and really differentiate yourself from the existing players. And while I was kind of looking around, you know, ideas of what I could do, the Vestiaire opportunities kind of came to me a bit out of nowhere. I didn't really know the company before.
Through a headhunter?
Yeah, through a headhunter, yeah. They connected me to the existing investors, and I had a chat with them, and I kind of looked at it, and I'm quite a, you know, gut-feeling person, and I just kind of loved it from the first minute I looked at it. And the main thing I really saw was this incredibly engaged customer base. You know, both buyer and sellers have an incredible kind of emotional connection. I mean, that's not just, you know, girls loving luxury fashion. It's really that secondhand brings that extra emotional engagement on the buyer's side, because you have this treasure hunt, you know, that one item that you always wanted but, you know, never found. And on the seller side, you basically open up your wardrobe. If you go on the app now and you type at Maximilian, you know, I'm probably the first one who comes up, and you see the 30 plus items I've sold over the last 12 months. I mean, you get an incredible insight into who I am and what I buy. I mean, that's the real stuff I wear and sold. And so the emotional connection was incredible. And I looked at the way the business was run at the time. You know, it did some things spectacularly well. It had, you know, amazing fashion DNA, you know, really kind of representing that Parisian, you know, fashion sense into the world. It had an amazing brand. It had, you know, the brand was built on very strong pillars, you know, about trust, about sustainability around the community. So all these things were really an incredibly raw diamond to build on. And I really felt that with my experience from Lazada, you know, I could firstly bring just some best practices on e-commerce platform governance to the team, but most importantly, kind of bringing that vision of engagement, community, and just building on that existing fire, which was, you're ready to unfold. So that's pretty much what got me excited.
Vestiaire Collective is, unfortunately, a slightly rare French success story on online. We always think of online as an American, Anglo-Saxon, or or certainly an Asian thing. Why do you think that is, after a year or two?
Why is e-commerce maybe an American
thing? Two
sides
of the questions. Why is it that? And why has it been successful?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at e-commerce, it's really about economies of scale. I mean, it's you know, people always say, you know, e-commerce takes a bit of time to become profitable, because to build the traffic, to build, you know, the tech behind it, just takes time. But once it has the economies of scale, it's an incredibly profitable business model. And, you know, if you think the US and you think of China, you have these two markets, they're one market you can serve with one app or one website. So by definition, you know, American and Chinese websites will always have a massive advantage, because their home base is such a big customer base. Why do I think Vestiaire is an amazing opportunity? Because, you know, I think fashion is France, I mean, and fashion is Paris. So that DNA on which the company has been built, you know, is still ever present. Vestiaire is really unique because it has such a big catalog. We have now, you know, more than 2 million items on the platform. You compare that to Farfetch with, I don't know, 300,000. I mean, you can find a lot on the platform, and you really find rare pieces, unique pieces. Fashion lovers have really built the platform, have sold on the platform, are buying on the platform. And that really comes from its Parisian DNA.
It began out with the concept of some sophisticated Parisian women realizing they have all the stuff in their wardrobe, and they were just sort of hanging there. So it began from that point of, you know, sophisticated collectors. It's essentially a resale community for quality fashion.
Yes.
Do you sell any new fashion?
Yeah, I think there's a part on the platform which is new, or as good as new, still have the label in, because I think 40% of items women buy, I think they never wear, you know, presents which are the wrong size. So we do have people selling new, you know, as new stuff. Do we have
brands
selling stuff? Not really. That's really not our business. You know, do we have now during COVID some stores which might send off their end of life inventory? Maybe there's some, but it's not something we're actively pursuing, because we really believe that our business is, you know, these unique items that you can find nowhere else. And you think about the sheer volume that is out there. The luxury industry, you know, has somewhere around $300 billion of revenue a year. Now multiply that over, I don't know, 10 years. I mean, the amount of value that is lying in people's closet is, you know, close to $1 trillion. So, we have basically unlimited supply.
To the uninitiated, how does it work? What percentage do you charge? How does someone sell through you?
Roughly every sale on us has a 20% commission that we take. With that commission, we cover some of the shipping cost to our authentication hub. The main model is that you upload what you have in your closet. You take a picture with your mobile phone. You do a description. We then do a slight curation of the product. We do some check of authentication visually. And then upload it on the product. So we don't let everything onto the platform. We want to keep some sort of fashion level. We edit some of it. Then the product is online and gets bought. Yeah. And only upon sale does then the seller send it to us. We authenticate it. We check, you know, if the size is right, if it
doesn't have any holes. Or have you got a kind of standard
We have a standard kind of process where we send them the prepaid shipping label and they just need to organize the pickup or they drop it off at one of the postal post offices or something like that. And then they send it to us, we check it and we send it to the customer. That's the main heart of the business, the C2C business on which the business was built 10 years ago.
And that hasn't changed, really.
Well, no, I think one of the things I've introduced just over a year ago now was a service called direct shipping. We've seen that, you know, while our business works extremely well for high basket sizes and that service of authentication that we provide is you know, greatly appreciated by many customers, there's also lower price points, let's say 80, 90 euros, a secondhand Cezanne dress, where that kind of operating model of shipping the item twice is just quite expensive and also not that sustainable. So we've introduced the model called direct shipping, where we give the customers the choice to opt out of authentication, where they then save shipping costs and save authentication costs.
But
that's been a huge driver.
Good. But that tends to be with the seller you know already, or can it be?
Yes, exactly. So I think what we've also done is we've built a lot of transparency about the sellers. Are they trusted? Are they expert sellers? We de facto leave the customer the choice. If they want to have authentication, they can get any item authenticated. We provide that service for them.
You charge a slightly higher percentage.
Exactly.
What's the difference in the percentage?
We don't charge a different percentage to the seller. We don't charge the shipping fee to the buyer. Buyer can save some money.
Okay. How do you maintain that? I mean, how many countries are you reaching now?
You can buy from over 70 countries and you can sell from close to 50 countries in the world.
That's quite a lot.
It's a big global operation.
Oh, that's good. How do you maintain the Parisian touch?
good question. I mean, you're looking at me. I don't think I don't think I do that. You know, it's really, you know, huge credit to Fanny, who's the founder and also the president of the group today. You know, she's been in the business since the beginning. She moved to London, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. About 2 years ago, she moved to Hong Kong. So she's really the one spreading that Parisian DNA in the world and you know, keeping definitely me in check on making sure that we keep that DNA intact. But it's not just, you know, I think that Parisian part will never go away from us, but we're also very proud of our global community. I mean, it's the fact that, you know, we get incredible pieces of fashion in Hong Kong and that item gets sold to New York, items being bought in Sydney from Italy. You know, we believe in our global community and in some sort of way, you know, you have to look at Vestiaire as, it's the global digital wardrobe, which is really a representation of your wardrobe, my wardrobe, and that wardrobe of anyone in our, you know, in our community. And we really want to build on that community side, not just from a buying and selling perspective, but also educating consumers on the circularity part, on the sustainability part of our business, because fundamentally we are a sustainable business. You know, fashion. So much focus has been on sustainability over the last years. And there's solutions out there, but there's very few solutions out there which are not greenwashing. We're an actually sustainable business in fashion.
There are very few solutions which are not actually
greenwashing.
Meaning what?
They're just, kind of, you put a green sticker on it and make it sound like it's sustainable. So we're actually extremely passionate and will get much more vocal on the fact that consuming secondhand, both buying and selling, you know, really makes a difference versus consumer.
Do you think potentially you are a bit of a threat to the growth of some luxury brands precisely because you're getting...
I really don't think we are. I think we're much more of a threat to fast fashion because if you think about it, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Vestiaire defines a value to a second-hand item. after 6 months, 12 months, 10 years. You know, we make these luxury items not consumables, but we basically make them assets. So if you know the item you bought for, let's say, 1,000 euros, you can resell it at 500, 600 euros after 1, 2, 3 years. Yeah. You own an asset. Your approach to paying the high price of a first-hand luxury item changes. While with fast fashion, you know, you pay much less, but you also only use it 4 or 5 times and you never give it that value. So I think what we want to do and we try to educate the market is that we want people to trade up, because if they trade up, they buy stuff that is more long-lasting. It's amazing craftsmanship, and it doesn't lose its value. So I think we just want to enable that market. So I think in some sort of way, I think it's more a win-win situation. Yeah.
What percentage of the sales do you have for returns compared to sales?
No. We don't offer returns, but we allow the seller, if it's the buyer, if it's the wrong product or the wrong size, to resell the product for free within 7 days.
Okay. And what percentage of it does that?
Very low.
Like 5, 10?
Below that, yeah.
Okay. So that solves a big problem, which a lot of internet companies face.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Okay. That's nice in your business model. Do you have any physical boutiques?
We had a partnership with Selfridges, which we launched just over a year ago, which was a fantastic success. You know, Selfridges is extremely focused on sustainability. We're obviously very passionate and sustainable on that. And I think together we made quite a big statement at the time. It's not our core business. I'm digital at heart. Yeah. You know, my previous company was an e-commerce company. Now it's an e-commerce company. So I'm not one of those guys who are launching stores left, right, and center. I think it was a good partnership. It was more from a consumer education.
More branding, media.
Yeah, consumer education perspective.
Who are the designers you admire? Or who are the designers you wear?
I wouldn't say I'm a fashionista. I wear a lot of, you know, nice Italian clothes, you know, whether it's Loro Piana or Brunello, and I keep it quite basic, yeah. But I've started. I mean, fact of the matter is I've got hooked on the platform myself. You know, a Loro Piana jumper or a Brunello jumper, cashmere costs, you know, north of 1,000 euros now. I mean, that's a lot of money if you think about it. Yeah. Secondhand, you can get them on Vestiaire for 250, 300. And you can resell it, actually. I've actually just last week sold some of the items that I bought a year ago for the first time at Vestiaire, and the second time selling it, I didn't even pay that much of a discount to my first purchase. No, so
it was a good investment.
Yeah.
Investment dressing. Major brands here, not only in Paris, largely in Paris, but, you know, to an extent also in Italy, and LVMH certainly, their brands, and Chanel, and Hermes, I mean, the really big luxury brands.
The serious guys.
You know, they're like the heavyweights. You know what I mean? The
guys, 800-pound gorillas.
You know what I mean? The guys like, you know, the Rocky Marciano, the Muhammad Ali's of the business.
Yeah.
They've been very hesitant about online. It's considered part of the consumer journey, but, you know, they don't actually sell that much. And Bernard Arnault or Bruno Pavlovsky at, you know, Chanel, the manager of Chanel, slightly, they don't really think that, you know, at Chanel or at LVMH, that they really want to sell so much, and they haven't been convinced. Why do you think that is? And do you think that's a mistake?
I mean, I haven't spoken with either of the gentlemen that you mentioned about that topic, or I haven't actually spoken to them at all, so I don't know what they're thinking about it is. You know, I guess, you know, it's part of keeping the mystique of the brand and the exclusive experience when you go in one of the stores, and maybe they're afraid that they cannot replicate that online, and maybe the whole pricing becomes much more, you know, transparent. You know, there's lots of ways to think about it. I try not to think too much about it, because fundamentally it doesn't really concern me.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I'm my supply comes from, you know, millions of closets, you know, in people's homes, and it's the same product I'm selling. You know, that's the wonderful democratic idea behind the internet, and especially behind e-commerce, that you know you don't need to be an 800-pound gorilla to win. Do I think it's a mistake? You know, I don't think it's a mistake, but it opens up opportunities for small guys like me to go after the opportunity, because in the end, it's not what they want and what I want; it's what the consumer wants. And if you, you know, look at yourself, if you go outside on the road, everyone is looking at their phone. And it's, I don't really like the idea of being online versus offline, because no one is ever really offline. Even when the customers in Avenue Montaigne are in the store, they're online, they're on their phone, they're looking maybe at the Vestiaire app. So, you know, the separation, I think, is an artificial one. The consumers are online. You know, my job is to be where the consumers are and to give them what they want and build the best experience around that.
Who owns Vestiaire Collective?
A couple of shareholders, myself included, Fanny and Sophie included. So management also owns a big stake.
If I remember rightly, Condé Nast.
Yeah, it's one of the shareholders, yeah.
What percentage do they own?
I can't disclose that.
But at one stage, they put in a significant amount.
They just recently reinvested in the company.
Something like 10 or 20% was my memory. That order.
Yeah, something like that.
Do they play a role?
Jonathan Newhouse joined the board.
Yeah. Is he still a member?
He's still on the board. I think he's been a fantastic supporter of the business, a fantastic supporter of me. I've had, you know, amazing work relationship with him, and he's a great mentor. Is there a big commercial partnership between the two? You know, we've tested things in the past, here and there, but it's not. I mean, it's mainly a financial investment for them.
Yeah. So it's not, there aren't actual synergies with their websites or their magazines.
There have been things that the two parties have worked in commercially in the past, but nothing currently.
Nothing currently. How do you see the pandemic changing? How has it changed and how do you see it changing?
You know, I think I'm not a... I think what I'm saying is not a, you know, fundamental unique insight. Yeah. I mean, but I'm sure you've heard it many other places. Yeah. I think what the pandemic has done is that it's just accelerated the digitization of everything we do dramatically. I mean, my parents didn't know what Zoom was 6-7 months ago, and now I have Zoom calls with them. You know, I'm amazed that they can actually log in. You know, I hope they don't listen to this. I think everything we do has just become much more digitized. I mean, the way we pay is much less cash now. The way we order in the restaurant, you know, everywhere you have the QR codes now instead of looking at the menus. It's just accelerated the digitization. So what I think, you know, the pandemic has done, and I think that is hard to reverse, is just accelerated the already very big trend towards digitization by, you know, I think at least 3, 4, 5 years, which is, you know, clearly, you know, an advantage for a business like ours.
Tell me a little bit about you, where you grew up and how you studied and got into what you're doing today.
Sure. So I grew up in Munich for a long time. I lived a bit in the US when I was a younger boy. Then went...
Where did you live there?
In New York.
Okay.
My parents moved there for work, so I followed them.
What did your father do there?
Back then he was a consultant.
Okay. Yeah. In New York?
In New York.
Yeah. And you lived where, in Manhattan?
No, outside, suburbs.
Where, oh, you were? Long Island?
This is Scarsdale.
Scarsdale. And you went to school, high school?
I went to, no, it was a primary school in White Plains. It was a German school of White Plains.
Oh, I didn't know there was such a thing. Great. And that's where you've got your good English.
That's where the first attempts to learn English. Then I was sent, or I went, I don't know who you ask, up to Scotland to boarding school at the age of 16.
Which one?
Glenalmond.
Oh, okay. So that was much... more serious.
Much more serious, yeah. I went there to visit the school, and it was a Sunday afternoon on that one sunny day they have a year. And the boys were coming out of the chapel playing rugby in kilts, and my parents were just mesmerized by it, and I was just shaking my head.
And you were left behind.
And here I was, I was left behind in the miserable Scottish weather. And then afterwards, I studied in London and started off my career in London for about 10 years before moving to Chicago for business school and then actually spending a bit of time back in Germany before moving to Southeast Asia to found Lazada.
What would your advice to be to a young guy or girl who wanted to pursue a career in fashion or luxury management? Three things.
Three things. You know, I really have to admit I'm not an expert on the luxury industry by any means of imagination. I think it's... you know, I've been here now for 18 months in Paris. It's a peculiar animal, the fashion industry, with incredibly fascinating people. You know, I would very much still think I'm an outsider, so I don't have any inside tips. And I think in general, you know, any advice I would give people who want to go into luxury industry or any industry is, you know, you need to do what you like. You know, don't do things because they look glamorous or they look fancy. Because in the inside, most jobs are the same, and the fundamental thing is that you need to enjoy what you do. I think the second part is, you know, don't run where everyone else is running. You know, ideally run somewhere where the ball might be. Yeah, you know, if you go to you know, if you're a soccer player and you keep on chasing the ball, you're probably not a very good soccer player. So you have to go run somewhere where you think the ball is going to be, and then you might score a goal. And the last one is you know, don't be intimidated by the powers to be. You know, I think things change. I mean, even in luxury, you know, I'm a believer that innovating is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. So stick to that.
What, I mean, Vestiaire Collective is, you know, most people think a very good success. What is the turnover of the company?
We don't really disclose that, but it's fairly sizable now. Roughly, let's call it 400 million.
Oh, well, very good.
GMV a year, yeah.
Yeah, unprofitable.
Not quite. Getting there slowly.
Very good, sir. Maximilian.
Max Bittner. Is fine.
Very a pleasure. It's a pleasure talking to a Bayern Munich fan, especially in the year they won their sixth Champions League.
Thank you so much. I cannot take too much credit for it.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.